Friday.
Well, how'd you have a good weekend?
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you later in the week when I find out how I get through with the Senate on Thursday. Yeah, I did it, Fred, and I hope you did too.
Is that what you're working on?
Yes.
Testimony?
Yeah.
What do you go up with Thursday, the appropriation?
The supplement. The $12.5 billion.
Senate going to hear you first?
Yes. Russell on combined armed services and appropriations on Thursday.
What you're thinking these days? I haven't talked to you. What's happening to our pause? What are our generals saying?
I sat with George Ball and Mac Bundy late Saturday to consider what's happening on the pause, and I think we agreed that we still aren't sure, and that there are a number of leads that we should follow up so that by the end of this week we'd be in a position to make some kind of a recommendation to you. We should go back to Rangoon and have our ambassador there approach that consul and say, 3 or 4 weeks ago I gave you a note to send to your government. I haven't heard. When will I get an answer? We should go to Kohler in Moscow and say, Shastri told us, Kosygin said you should contact the North Vietnamese. What does they tell you? We should go through Rapotsky in Poland and say, you promised to go to North Vietnam. We haven't heard a word from you. And follow each one of these hot leads or warm leads so that by the end of the week we can tell you that we've checked them off and there's nothing more to expect from them. I think that there's a feeling in some parts of the state, particularly George, that we shouldn't resume bombing at the end of Tet. Of course, over here among the chiefs, there's a feeling we should have resumed before this. I think my own feeling is, and I think Sy's as well, that we were well advised to continue the pause through Tet in order to allow an ample period of time to elapse for North Vietnam to respond to any one of these several lines of contact and to establish firmly in the minds of our own public and in the minds of the international public that we gave a reasonable time for them to respond. And that reasonable time in my mind will have elapsed with the end of Tet. I think you'll get some criticism if you resume bombing at that point, but unless something develops between now and then, I would certainly urge that you do so. That's a week from today or a day or two later. I have just gotten the memo you had Jack Lundy send me from Arthur Goldberg, and I'm just reading it. And I'll be prepared to comment on it to you later today.
I'm rather amazed at the minimum amount of hell raising that's come forth on the polls, aren't you?
Not really. I think that the Republicans read the same poll the rest of us did that showed the wives and mothers of this country don't want war. And they're just scared as hell to come out and say, you should have started bombing last week. And I noticed Jerry Ford this morning and yesterday was very, very careful on this point, simply showing the support you have for it in the country.
What do you get anything in your cables from Westmoreland or any of his people?
Yes, it's clear they would like to see it resumed as promptly as possible, although they're being very quiet and very, very well disciplined, I think. I talked to a number of members of the press at the end of last week and over the weekend, including yesterday, and they're just not getting any bitching, as far as I can tell, from the military, either here or in South Vietnam, about the extension of the pause.
Jack Sutherland told me that he had been to lunch with a general last Friday. He's U.S. News and World Report.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it this week. Said he was raising hell and said we were throwing the war away. I didn't ask him what.
I'm sure there are many that feel that, Mr. President, but I have noticed very, very little reflection of that view in the press attributed to military personnel.
Well, do you think then we're going to have a sentiment that will support our resumption if everybody feels this way about it?
I think so, Mr. President. Particularly among the great majority of the people in this country, I think you'll find some foreign leaders will criticize you if you resume bombing on the 26th as an illustration. I think Nasser will feel that it would have been wiser to continue the pause. I think probably Aiken and Mansfield and Church and McGovern certainly will feel that way. But I think the great majority of the people in the country will believe that you gave them a reasonable time, over a month, and there was no movement at all on their part. As a matter of fact, intelligence information that we get back doesn't indicate that they're even thinking of moving at this point. We haven't yet had any reflection of Schlepin's visit from Moscow, and that might throw somewhat different light on the statement I just made, but no other intelligence source that I've seen indicates that Hanoi is even considering moving toward negotiation in order to lead us to extend the pause. I keep thinking they will give some indication of that. It would just seem smart bargaining on their part to do so. They could get a continuation of the pause with very, very little action. Even if they came in with some questions, we'd almost be forced to extend it. But I haven't seen any evidence that they'll move in that direction. I was so concerned about it that I had brought over here Friday or Saturday the leading British authority on North Vietnam, a man named Honey, Professor Honey. And he's been following them for years and years and years, and we found him useful in the past. And I talked to him Saturday at Desai, and his own analysis was that the balance of power in Hanoi and among the Politburo there is such that it's in the hands of what I'd call hardliners, and particularly it's in the hands of the first secretary of the Communist Party, a man named Le Duan, L-E-D-U-A-N, who was in command in the South in 1954 at the time of the Geneva Accords, and who always felt that Ho Chi Minh made a serious tactical error at that time. He had the war won. He let himself be negotiated out of it at Geneva, and who today, therefore, is putting considerable pressure on Ho Chi Minh and others to ensure continuing a war that he thinks they either are winning or can win. But in any event, whether that's a proper interpretation or not, and I'm not prepared to say it is, I don't see the signs of movement toward negotiation by them, much as I have been looking for them, much as I'd like to see them.
Do you see any signs of dangers built up during this period, or that we've sacrificed much?
I don't, Mr. President. I do see signs of dangers build up, but I don't think that it's a result of the pause, nor do I think it would have been prevented if we had not had a pause. But I do definitely see signs of
build-up. Want to watch that and be prepared on
that's
it, because
right.
I think that's going to be a campaign issue.
Mr. President, I'm sure it is.
And
I think the longer you extend the pause, the more dangerous the campaign issue becomes.
I think that's right.
But I am prepared to say that the action they have taken, which has led to this buildup, was decided upon and originated prior to the start of the pause.
What about their defections and their desertions?
Well, we've had an interesting report from a man named Goray, who works for the RAND Corporation, and we hired the RAND Corporation to go out there and carry on over a period of months an extensive interrogation of Viet Cong prisoners and defectors. His report shows what I think you've heard from other sources. First, that the number of defections has increased substantially. I've forgotten the exact figures, but it's on the order of 10,000 for 1965 versus 2,000 for 1964. The 10,000 still being a rather low number of defections from a force that's at least 250,000 in total. And these 10,000 may include Viet Cong sympathizers as well as members of that force, so that it's not a great number, but it's a substantially larger number than in 1964. Much more important than the number of defectors is the attitude that they reflect of the morale of those who haven't defected. They say, for example, that they're ridden with disease, they're harassed by air, they're constantly forced to move, they have no sanctuary in which they can rest and recuperate. The bases that they formerly used with the deep underground tunnels and caves are under constant attack. They never know when they're safe. They find it difficult to obtain hot food. They find it difficult to move. They're short of medicines. The rate of incidence of malaria and other diseases, and particularly in the Viet Cong and the Highlands, appears to run between 25% and 35%. And many of them are discouraged, and many who did believe that they were winning or would win now question whether they will. Now, I don't want to indicate to you the morale is shot, not many. I just want to indicate that the pressure that is being applied to them by air and by constant offensive probing by government and U.S. forces is beginning to appear in morale.
What do you hear from the Kennedy boys on this?
I haven't talked to Teddy. I called him over the holidays to wish him holiday greetings, but I haven't talked to him since he got back. I have talked to Bobby about it. He was very pleased to see the pause started. I think he feels that we've got to continue to increase our forces there, but that we ought to carry on efforts toward negotiations or some form of non-military settlement. As do I. I think if we resume the bombing, Mr. President, we ought to continue to carry on a number of these diplomatic moves. You remember the suggestion for the Six Nation meeting that came up in your office when Dean Rusk and George were present one day about a week or 10 days ago. Well, that kind of action, it seems to me, ought to be initiated even after we resume bombing, if we do.
Will Bobby oppose resuming bombing in the light of the New York Times? I assume they will. They're going to oppose anything we do, aren't they?
Well, I don't know if they'll oppose it. I think they'll say we didn't wait long enough or he didn't handle it right during the intervening period. They may oppose it as well. I talked to Scotty Reston Friday or Saturday, and my impression was that he personally would oppose it. Oppose the resumption.
What's his thinking?
Well, it just isn't militarily effective, and therefore, continuing the pause, you don't suffer a military penalty, and you may obtain a political advantage.
That's not correct, though. You think you do?
I think you suffer
a military
penalty. I think
penalty,
you suffer a military penalty in the sense, Mr. President, they can carry on the war in the South at a lower cost to their society. It doesn't cost them nearly as much to infiltrate the men and the equipment without our bombing as it does with our bombing. And I am absolutely certain in my own mind, beyond that the bombing represents a political pressure which we benefit from. The very fact that we're talking about negotiations, the very fact the Soviets have put pressure on them, the other nations in the world have put pressure on them, is a result of our bombing, which pressure would not have been put on them if we hadn't had the bombing. The bombing represents something we can give up in return for something they'll do at some point. Apparently, this isn't the point.
Tell me about the women out there, Bob. I'm getting the post is starting nagging at
the lack of women?
Yeah, in the services. There's nothing but nurses. Say that you won't let any of the wax go or any of the waves go or any of the rest of
them.
We could sprinkle any of them out there.
It hasn't been, frankly, the question of waves and wax hasn't been brought to me, Mr. President. I would oppose it. I think it'll just cause a tremendous amount of unrest and trouble. We won't let the wives go out there. Of officers or enlisted men or diplomatic personnel, and to introduce waves or wax, in the first place, they don't add anything in the way of efficiency to the operation. In the second place, they require a lot of special quarters and special handling. In the third place, it causes morale problems because of apparent discrimination. The wives in Bangkok are just sore as hell that their wives are civilian employees and female employees out there. And beyond that, the wives of foreign diplomats allied with us. For example, the Australian diplomats are allowed in Saigon, and they see pictures of young American women in the area, and they wonder what their husbands are doing. It seems to me that to send waves and wax will simply accentuate that problem. And I haven't felt any pressure for it. As a matter of fact, none of the services even raised the question with me. But I'll look into it.
Oh, no, I wouldn't stir it up, but they're raising hell with me, and I assume that it's coming from, they say, some Major Bonnie, somebody of the Air Force, whatever, I guess WAX, Air Force, whatever you call them, asked for duty, and they told them they didn't want them unless they're a nurse. So they got about 250, 300 nurses.
Well, I noticed an article or two a week or so ago about it. I didn't follow it up then because I just want to let sleeping dogs lie on this thing, but I can do so at any time.
No, I think we'll just let it go. I'll tell them I got a question at my press conference about it, and they said they were very distressed from a lady from the Washington Post. So I just anticipated I'd get that.
Yeah.
Do you think we ought to have a meeting? When's Dean coming back, you know?
He should be back tomorrow, I believe. He was stopping in the Philippines yesterday.
Are we doing everything we can now with the Philippines and with the Koreans to get them to come in?
Yes, we are.
Got any indication they're going to come?
Well, the Koreans, there's no question what the Koreans will come. It's just a matter of price. And they turned in a request for several hundred million. It was about $600-700 million worth of dollars.